Tonight's meeting, of course, is the Marx and Alienation, and the speaker is Comrade Peter Lawrence. And since we are running later than what it was originally anticipated, I'm going to ask Comrade Lawrence to open up on the subject of Marx and Alienation.
Good evening, comrades and friends. I thought in talking about alienation tonight, I would open up some of the controversial aspects of the concept of alienation, because quite definitely there have been two views about the importance of this concept within the body of Marx's work. The first view is that the notion of alienation was an immature involvement by Marx with post-Hegelian philosophy, which marked a phase of Marx's intellectual development in response to the intellectual climate of the 1830s and 1840s, and that subsequently, as Marx developed his economic theories, the labour theory of value, and particularly the materialist conception of history, he dropped the idea of alienation. That's one view. And this view would argue that, in fact, the concept of alienation is not important within the whole body of Marx's work. There is a second point of view which argues that alienation remains the most important central concept of Marx's work, and that everything that Marx did after the 1840s, his economic theories and his theory of history, was in fact an elaboration of his view of human alienation, so that there are two quite distinct and opposing approaches to the importance of this question of alienation within Marx's works. And these two viewpoints, I must say, have been reflected in the party. There's a quite notable example of this in the issue of the Socialist Standard for May 1978, which happened to put these two quite different views about the importance of alienation. You had an article on the back page by a comrade in Sweden, I think his name is Spross, which takes the first view that I outlined, that in fact the concept of alienation is not important, that it simply was some immature involvement by Marx with something that did not develop in an important way. He says here, for example, that the young Marx, in his first presentation of the case for socialism, based it on a philosophical humanism, using concepts and expressions like human essence, man's alienation from his species life, and man's return to his human existence. And he says, later, however, Marx came to base the case for socialism on the interests of the working class under capitalism and not on any philosophical view of human nature. So what Spross is saying in this article of the Socialist Standard is that this concept of alienation expresses a view of Marx that is based on a philosophical view of human nature and therefore is not to be taken seriously. He says, however, whatever were the views of the young Marx, Marxism does not stand or fall with them. In other words, he seems to be apologising here that Marx ever entertained the concept of alienation, because he's trying to explain it away, and then he gives examples of the more important work that Marx went on to do. And what he's suggesting is here that we can consign all this dabbling with the concept of alienation to these immature writings of Marx, which in the long term are of no significance. Another article in the Socialist Standard in the same issue put a quite different point of view. It was actually written by me. And I related the concept of alienation directly to Marxian economic theories and to Marx's theory of history. And I took the concept of alienation as being included in Marx's work, and that it was something he never dropped. And I say here that the alienation of man is a direct consequence of capitalist productive relationships, and then I go on at length. So that issue of the socialist standard then expresses these quite two different views about the importance of the concept of alienation. Now, I want to come back to this later, but to begin with, I want to make some general remarks about the idea of alienation, because a lot of people use the expression. It has all sorts of shades of meaning, and you cannot consider the concept of alienation without considering the nature of human consciousness. Human consciousness is consciousness of consciousness. It is self-awareness. The human animal is the only animal that can reflect upon its own existence. Not only to reflect upon the inevitability of individual death, but also to reflect upon the quality of life. And a lot of writers have taken this a long way in dealing with the concept of alienation. For example, a writer called Rojak, in his book The Making of a Counterculture, said that it was this ability of man to consider through his own particular form of consciousness his own existence objectively, which mentally distances man from his own existence. And this Rojak saw as the basis of a separation of man and his own place in nature. So he's taken this special qualities of human consciousness a very long way indeed. I wouldn't take it that far, but you are bound to say that because of the nature of human consciousness, one can objectively reflect on one's own existence, and you can have a vision of what one would like to be, which can be compared objectively in your own mind with the reality of what one is. And whilst it is perfectly possible to be mentally at ease with the sort of person one is and the kind of life that one is leading, it is equally possible for there to be a wide gap between one's vision of oneself and the reality of self. Where this is experienced, you have the idea residing in the individual that what I am is not really me. There is a difference between how I see myself and what I actually am. And this is not necessarily an idea which just arises arbitrarily in someone's mind. It has an emotional content very often and is materially based in profound discontent and unhappiness and can be accompanied by a lot of stress. So in the imprecise way in which alienation is treated by a whole range of people, artists, literary people, and psychologists, what we are talking about is something that is alien. It does not belong. It is out of place. It is something which is out of its proper setting. It sums up a feeling in the individual that I do not belong in this place, that there is disharmony between what I feel to be my rightful self and the actual life that I am living. The feeling that what I am doing does not spring from me and does not fulfill me. That what I am doing, the kind of life that I am leading, is a response to forces or pressures which are external to me. They do not spring to me, and over which I have no individual control. That my ability to make decisions which affect my life and which spring from my own individuality is paralyzed, and that therefore I am powerless. More than that, alienation is also to do with the experience of loneliness and the isolation of the individual. And this is the experience of not only feeling a stranger in my own life, but that I lack any point of meaningful contact with others. And this leads to an experience of life which lacks solidity, is full of apprehension, anxiety, and a life which is vacuous and fragmented and not grounded in any secure or predictable basis. So these are themes and feelings which have been described in art and literature. A number of artists have treated the theme of alienation. Last year there was an exhibition of Edward Hopper's work, the modern American painter, and the characters and paintings that it is shown in his work evoke this mood and feeling of being lost in a rather vacuous world. I don't know how close you are, but this group of figures, for example, you can see that although they all inhabit the same space, they're all totally remote from each other and seem to have no interest in themselves. But there is this feeling of mutual isolation, and it all lacks life. So that's one artist's way. You notice that the characters don't look at each other. They seem to be lost in a very, very private and empty world. Another modern artist, a writer who has treated the theme of alienation in a rather brilliant way, I think, is Kafka. If any of you have read his novels like The Castle, for example, where this individual is trying to gain access into the inner sanctums of a castle and keeps running up against all sorts of problems, that he is totally powerless in everything that happens to him right throughout the novel. That again evokes this whole mood of powerlessness and lack of control. There's a connection between alienation and psychology too. Traditionally, the Vienna psychologists were described as alienists because madness was thought to be occur in a person who had been deserted by their true selves. And once again, you get this introduction of a notion of authentic self and what they actually are. They had been deserted by their true selves. And writers like R.D. Lang have written books like The Divided Self. Existentialist psychologists like Rollo May has written a book, Man's Search for Himself, and Carl Rogers wrote a book, On Becoming a Person. All these titles and themes evoke the idea of the authentic self, a difference between that and what people actually are. So this whole notion of alienation, I'm not suggesting that you consider them to be important or significant, but I'm just mentioning at the outset different ways in which artists and writers have dealt with the theme of alienation. I'll just mention briefly too that the counterculture and various other organisations have made much of the theme of alienation. For example, Philip Slater, who had a big influence on the counterculture in America and other places, wrote this book called The Pursuit of Loneliness. It's illustrated by a painting by Edward Hopper, which again evokes this mood of total isolation. And basically, Philip Slater's theme is that alienation is caused by technological society, that man has become separated from himself, from each other, and from nature in general because of the nature of modern technical society. And that actually is a very, very common theme running through the way in which the idea of alienation is treated. I'll just read you a little bit here. He says that we've been degraded and slaughtered at random, and this is the nature of our current relationship to our technological order. So he blames the whole experience of alienation on technology and the separation of man from nature. I would suggest that one of the more significant treatments of the theme of alienation, and the one that influenced Marx considerably, coming back to our original theme, is the notion of religious alienation that we get in Feuerbach, who saw the essence of man in universal love. But he said that it wasn't God who created man in God's own image. Was the other way around. It was human beings, man, who created God in man's own image. Religion is the relation based on the affections, the relation based on the heart between man and man, which until now has sought its truth in a fantastic reflection of reality, in the fantastic reflection of human qualities through the medium of one or more gods. So that what Feuerbach is saying is that human beings are relinquishing their essence and bestowing it in the nature of gods who then tyrannize in their minds man. So Feuerbach saw the essence of religion as being the essence of man and as the essence of man was his capacity for universal love, and as man relinquished his essence in the form of a god, man was separated or alienated from his own nature. At this point, I think it's useful to come back to the two views of the importance of alienation in Marx's work. As I said earlier, it is said by Spross in his article that the young Marx, in his first presentation of the case for socialism, based it on a philosophical humanism, using concepts and expressions like human essence, man's alienation from his species life, and man's return to his human existence. Now, my own view is that this is a complete distortion of Marx's thoughts and writings at this time, and it is based on a few selected quotes which do not reflect the balance of Marx's writings in the 1840s. In fact, Marx's writings show that his view of human alienation, alienated labour, was firmly grounded not in a view of abstract human essence or abstract human nature, but of historical man. And I want to quote from the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts to show, in fact, that this was the case. He says that political economy proceeds from the fact of private property, but it does not explain it to us. It expresses in general, abstract formulae, the material process through which private property actually passes. And these formulae it then takes for laws. It does not comprehend these laws. It doesn't demonstrate how they arise from the very nature of private property. And he goes on in this vein, and this shows quite clearly in these various texts. This is a text on estranged labour or alienated labour, to show that his concept of alienated labour was grounded firmly in a vision of human beings who were the product of history and who are acting and living within the context of specific productive relationships. It had absolutely nothing to do with some abstract vision of human nature whatsoever. He had already formulated his views quite firmly along the lines of the materialist conception of history, and he was understanding man in that context. So for Spross to say that he based the case for socialism on a philosophical humanism, some sort of view of human nature that man was alienated from, is quite contrary to the facts as you will find them in Marx's writing at this time. This book is full of the kind of material that I quoted to you. You can certainly say that Feuerbach argued his idea of religious alienation against the concept of human essence, which was not historically grounded. But even this would not tell the whole truth of Feuerbach's work. That is a black or white view which does not allow for any shade of grey or any acknowledgement that even revolutionary modes of thought have their origin in the continuous development of ideas. In fact, Feuerbach's concept of religious alienation marked as sharp a break with intellectual tradition as it is possible to get. And I would remind you that Marx was most generous when he came to speak of the importance of Feuerbach's work. And if I can quote again from the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, talking about Feuerbach's achievements, he listed as one of them the establishment of true materialism and of real science, since Feuerbach also makes the social relationships of man to man the basic principle of the theory. So even though the materialist view of human development is not complete in Feuerbach, nevertheless, if you think of how radical the thought is, that it is not God who creates man in God's own image, but man who creates God in man's own image, and that to be human is to be involved in a universal relationship of man to man, you have gone a very, very long way indeed towards the materialist view of human history. You are at least saying that social consciousness, that human consciousness is social consciousness and doesn't emanate from any source external to man's own ideas. And that is a very, very important and revolutionary breakthrough in my view. I am aware that the concept of alienation does present certain logical difficulties and apparent inconsistencies with the assumptions of the materialist conception of history. Firstly, you might well ask, how is it practically possible for human beings to be something other than what they truly are? To suggest this could happen would appear not to make any ordinary sense. It seems quite impractical and impossible. And secondly, you should argue that in the view of the materialist conception of history, you cannot understand human beings in terms of some fixed human essence. Man is the product of history and changes and develops through the historical process. As man develops society, he changes himself. You cannot argue any idea of what it is to be human which is independent of any particular social circumstances which are themselves the result of history. Therefore, the notion of alienation from some concept of fixed human essence in the light of the materialist conception of history is totally fallacious. Furthermore, even the options that present themselves about further change, such as the options that we have now of going from capitalism to feudalism, are historically given, not in the light of some return to authentic humanity, but in the light of the material problems which are thrown up by this particular age. So I think these are difficulties which have put members off the concept of alienation. It seems to be a vague concept which lacks precision, that the idea is subject to nuances of interpretation which are arbitrary and incapable of being referred to any specific body of evidence, and that the idea is written with all sorts of doubtful philosophical overtones. There's truth in that. With the economic theories, it's different. With the labour theory of value, it is certainly different. Here you have an analytical method which is most satisfactory in its explanation of social problems. It has predictive value, and the evidence of its usefulness is vindicated by experience time and time again. For this reason, the labour theory of value is more immediately useful in relation to the political stand that we take. And here the party has made a most important contribution to the Marxian criticism of society. The application of the labour theory of value to politics is the basis of our attitude to political reformism. We have shown, through the political application of the economic theories, that no political party can control the development of capitalism in a direction of its own choosing. So the economic theories relate very closely to the day-to-day contradictions of capitalism. So there is the view that the most important thing that we take from Marxism are the economic theories, and that you could forget all about alienation and it would not affect our political position or the general effectiveness of our criticism of capitalism. It is also said that Marx spent most of his time on his economic theories, and that this by itself suggests that Marx considered that the most important part of his work. Still, I want to remind you that if you have a look at Marx's life, like most people's lives, his life was a bit of a muddle. He did not do all the things that he wanted to do, and he did not have time for everything. In fact, we know that Marx's creative life was far from complete in terms of the things that he wanted to do, so you cannot read too much into Marx's written output. And you should also consider the form in which Marx's writings were published. The book that attracted most attention was obviously Volume 1 of Capital. But there were many contingent factors surrounding the publication of that book, and it should not be assumed that Marx himself considered that its publication reflected precisely the way in which he thought his ideas should be presented, taken as a whole, and had he enjoyed a completely free hand in the matter, which he certainly did not. The economic and philosophic manuscripts were not published until the 20th century, and certainly our early party comrades did not have them to hand. Another very important thing I want to stress is this, that despite what people like Spross have said, Marx never dropped the use of the term alienation. He used it consistently right throughout his working life, and references to it appear right through Capital and his other mature works, especially the term alienated labour. And I want to suggest that, taken as a whole, Marx's work is a unified elaboration of the theory of alienated man, that alienation is and remains at the heart of the Marxian view of the human situation under capitalism, that the materialist conception of history can be seen to amount to an explanation of how man came to be in this situation through successive phases of propertied society, and that the labour theory of value essentially analyses the mechanics and dynamics of alienation, and that the social revolution of socialism will end this condition of alienation. And for the sake of the argument, I want to draw on an analogy which Marx himself drew between Feuerbach's idea of religious alienation and Marx's concept of economic alienation. Just as in religion, Feuerbach sees man as being dominated by fantastic mental images of his own creation, which alienate him from his own best qualities, Marx saw man as being dominated by capital, which similarly alienated him from his own best qualities. And just as in the mind of the religious person, various gods seem to take on an independent, objective existence of their own, so under capitalism does capital accumulate according to its own necessary laws, which seem independent and beyond human control, so that man can be seen to be tyrannized by economic forces of his own creation. In one way, we can see capitalism as a system of producing and distributing wealth, but there is something fatally illusory about seeing capitalism as this, if we are not at the same time conscious of the fact that capitalism is not essentially about production. It is essentially and primarily about the accumulation of capital. It goes and it stops according to whether capital is being accumulated or not. It is not primarily a system which facilitates the production and distribution of wealth. Most of us here are too fully aware that the object of production is the further accumulation of capital through the exploitation of wage labour realised by selling commodities at a profit on the markets. Where it progresses, capitalism progresses as a system of exchange, and everything it does is conditional upon that. It is a world of commodities, and the social form of labour is wage labour, which has the unique quality, when it is put to use, of being able to create values over and above its own value. The conditions then on which wage labour enters the field of production is where it is expected to be the instrument of the further accumulation of capital. Those are the conditions on which workers have access to the productive process. And under capitalism, work activity is essentially and primarily an exchange of values, labour time for wages. The world that the worker inhabits is the world of economic values. And in this capacity, he has to obey all the laws of value. He is one commodity in a world of commodities which exist for the purpose of being exchanged. The alienated world of capitalism is one where humans being relate to each other essentially and primarily as economic categories, buyers and sellers, capitalists and workers. So work activity is not in pursuit the satisfaction of needs. That's got nothing to do with it. It is geared to the accumulation of capital. I want to remind you that seen in its most humanly desirable form, work is not simply practical activity carried on for a definite material purpose. It is the activity through which human beings most importantly express their social nature. And I imagine that for this to be experienced, the work has to be seen to be in direct line with the mutual interests of the participants. And it is because wage labour functions as an exchange of values that the work becomes drained of this particular human meaning. One of the most vicious aspects of economic alienation is seen in the way that the working class creates the economic forces of its own exploitation. Labour creates capital, and capital exploits labour. If I just may give you with a quote from Marx on these lines. These are very early writings of Marx, you know, in these philosophical and economic manuscripts, and in spite of them being from the 1840s, they go very, very much to the heart of the situation of capitalism today. And to dismiss them as being the immature ravings of somebody, you know, carried away by all sorts of ideas about abstract notions of human essence does them a great disservice, I always feel. This is from... The more the worker expends himself in more work, the more powerful becomes the world of objects which he creates in the face of himself. And the poorer he himself becomes in his inner life, the less he belongs to himself. It is just the same as in religion. And here is Marx is drawing on this analogy with religious alienation. The more of himself man attributes to God, the less he has left in himself. The worker puts his life into the object, and his life then belongs no longer to him, but to the object. The greater his activity, therefore, the less he possesses. What is embodied in the product of his labour is no longer his. The greater this product is, therefore, the more he himself is diminished. The alienation of the worker and his product means not only that his labour becomes an object, takes on its own existence
in commodity form and eventually as capital,
but that exists outside him, independently and alien to him, and that it stands opposed to him as an autonomous power. The life which he has given to the object sets itself against him as an alien and hostile force. And of course you can see this in the way that generations of working class have created all the means of production that exist, the whole productive apparatus, and now that whole vast productive apparatus in the form of capital, which generations of workers have created, now stand opposed to the working class as a hostile and exploitative economic force. And that, as I say, in my mind, is one of the most vicious aspects of alienation. One of the tragedies, I think, of this whole way in which under capitalism workers enter the productive process of sellers of labour power is that work appears to them simply as an acquisitive activity, something else that Marx, I won't read the whole quote, but briefly, labour appears in political economy only in the form of acquisitive activity. So the only meaning that work has is in terms of the amount of wages you get for the amount of time you work. The actual content of the work activity, what it means to other human beings, work as an expression of human relationships, counts for nothing. It is an exchange of values and only has significance for the worker in terms of what he is getting for his labour time. Work as an acquisitive activity totally drained of all its important human content. What we are experiencing now in the modern world is a tremendous growth of the human powers of production. the necessities of capital accumulation require that more efficient methods of production be introduced,
but the limitations of the market cripple their use.
It is the requirements of capitalism, the accumulation of capitalism, this economic monster that human beings have created through these successive phases of property society, that call men now to war with each other and diverts vast amounts of social labour into armaments and the technique of human destruction. This economic monster that human beings themselves have created. It is the profit motive that denies two-thirds of the world's population enough food to sustain good health. They simply don't constitute a market, hungry people.
It is the constraints of the market under capitalism which currently create over 20 million unemployed in Europe and America alone. So once again, this economic monster that humanity has created through the various phases of history now exists apparently beyond all rational control and tyrannizing human beings, the working class, to their tremendous cost. Well, in socialism, wealth will be produced directly for human need. And although we speak of the common ownership of the means of production, this is only to distinguish it from capitalism. In fact, the means of production will be a social facility at the free disposal of the community. Work activity will be the self-affirmation of the individual within the context of the community. It will be life-enhancing because it will be the practical activity through which the individual will develop his or her personality in association with others. This is not the separation of the individual from the product and therefore from himself, but the confirmation of the worth of his or her place within the community. This is a conciliation of the needs of individuality with the interests of the whole community, both of which need each other. Individual development cannot take place without the community, and the interests of the community are served by the free development of its members. I want to introduce, in connection with this theme of alienation, two important concepts which have been talked about a lot: freedom and meaning. We don't pursue the idea of freedom in any abstract sense. We specify the constraints on human activity which at present exist, the productive relationships of capitalist society. We also specify the changed relationships which will provide the practical, real material basis for the removal of those constraints, a social revolution to convert the class monopoly of the means of production into the common property of the whole community. This will provide for vital freedoms which do not exist under capitalism now. The freedom to provide enough food, the freedom to house people comfortably, the freedom to end violence, and not least the freedom of the individual to develop his or her potentialities. Also a concept of meaning, because one of the dimensions or aspects of alienation is the total meaningless of a lot of people's lives. The sale of energy for wages and the production of commodities for profit on the market cannot, in any circumstances, be construed sensibly as being meaningful in any human terms. To participate in the production of useful things directly for human need is a meaningful activity. And so socialism will provide the material basis for these two, for this important freedom, the freedom to live a meaningful life. In summarizing what I've said, and particularly in relation to these two views about the concept of alienation and its importance within the work, Marx's work, I want to make two points. The first is that we are describing a situation of alienation now, which has been arrived at through all the processes of history. So it's just not an abstract view of alienation, which is quite separate from the real material history of human beings. That we have at our disposal now powers of production that we cannot use within the present system of productive relationships. Man's capacity to produce is now paralyzed by the class monopoly of the means of production and resources and the objectives of capitalist production, the accumulation of capital. This elaborates the concept of alienation in a way which is entirely consistent with the materialist view of humanity. Secondly, I see absolutely no reason why you should not argue this concept of alienation against a set of human characteristics which are part of what it is to be human, which are a necessary and consistent feature of social humanity, regardless of the particular forms that social organization takes at different stages of the historical process. Here I would say that the process of human existence is the process of social labor. And this always remains true whether you have Paleolithic hunting and gathering, primitive Neolithic farming, the city-states of classical society, European feudalism, or modern industrial capitalism. Now, you may object to describing this process of social labor through which man accumulates his social experience and therefore makes history. You may object to describing it as the human essence. I'm not going to quibble about that. But I think you will have to agree that you cannot think of humanity without thinking of these essential human qualities. And moreover, if you want to specify what it is about humanity that distinguishes it from the rest of nature, be it the rest of the animal world or whatever, these are the features of humanity which make it unique. And they are always present, regardless of particular social forms. And I see no objection, therefore, to arguing that man, now in 1982, stands alienated from his own essential human qualities. I see no objection to that whatsoever, and I'll be interested to see if any other members do take exception to it. In my mind, this penetrating insight into the position of man in 1982, which at once reveals and clarifies the human tragedy, and at the same time holds out so much hope for the future, elaborated through the theory of value and the materialist conception of history, is at the summit of Marx's work. There's no doubt about that in my novel's work. And it converts everything that Marx ever did from something that might otherwise be an academic exercise into the sort of knowledge that man is yearning to grasp for his own betterment. Thank you.